the global elites really do good while their businesses are being bad?
I became interested in how it was that we live in this age in which rich people are, on the one hand, so generous, and on the other hand, so determined to cling to a set of economic and social arrangements that predictably, reliably, foreseeably shut most Americans out of a better life.
That's Anand Giridharadas. We talk with him about his groundbreaking new book, Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. Then we find out about a different way of doing business, the cooperative movement that's sweeping the globe. We talk with Nathan Schneider about his book, Everything for Everyone, The Radical Tradition That's Shaping the Next Economy. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. When Anand Giridharadas finished his book, Winners Take All, he didn't know if it would be praised or pilloried. That's because it blows the cover off how the efforts of the global elite to, quote, change the world for the better, actually preserve the status quo. A status quo that causes the very problems philanthropy later tries to solve. Giridharadas is no stranger to those elites. As a former New York Times columnist and a commentator for CNN, MSNBC, and NPR, and speaker at TED and the Aspen Institute, he's rubbed shoulders with the lords and ladies of what he calls a new kind of feudalism. Surprisingly, some of those elites have been receptive to his message, even though he pulls no punches. He asks hard questions like, why should our gravest problems be solved by the unelected upper crust instead of the public institutions it erodes by lobbying and dodging taxes? Good question. I used to cover the corporate social responsibility beat as a journalist and radio producer. I was often skeptical of the idea that the profit motive could solve the very social problems it created. But my questions about it were usually met with expressions of bafflement. Now, in Winners Take All, Giridharadas tackles the myths of philanthrocapitalism in a way that even the elites cannot ignore. Well, Anand Giridharadas, thank you so much for coming on to Writer's Voice.
I'm happy to be with you.
This book, Winners Take All, it's a kind of emperors have no clothes book. You write that the book's an attempt to understand the connection between the elite's social concerns and their predation, between the extraordinary helping and the extraordinary hoarding, between the milking of an unjust status quo and the attempt to repair a small part of it. Deconstruct that sentence for us.
We live in this age of extraordinary generosity, an age in which billionaires make headlines every day giving money away, in which 184 people have signed the giving pledge to give a majority of their wealth away, super wealthy people, in which at the opposite end of the life spectrum, many young graduates of elite, our most elite universities, are ardent about making a difference and changing the world and set out into the world with designs on doing so. And yet, this age of tremendous generosity has also been, for far too many Americans, perhaps most Americans, the age in which the American dream has basically disappeared, the age in which the chance to get ahead and out-earn one's parents has fallen from 90% to 50%, the age in which the fruits of economic growth have almost entirely been monopolized by those on top, an age in which recovery from the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression, the recovery was almost entirely monopolized by elites, including those who had caused it, and in which most Americans still remain 10 years later poorer in net worth terms than they were before. And I became interested in how it was that we live in this age in which rich people are, on the one hand, so generous, and on the other hand, so determined to cling to a set of economic and social arrangements that predictably, reliably, foreseeably shut most Americans out of a better life.
And it's very much driven by a certain kind of ideology, an ideology that you call market world. What is market world?
Market world, you know, I found a long time ago in writing that if you want to help people see reality they're familiar with in a new way, you kind of coin things that try to reorganize reality in the way you want people to look at it. And so I kind of coined market world as a catch-all term for a lot of different things that I try to roll together. Market world is a complex of people and institutions that are trying to do well by doing good. They're trying to make the world a better place while protecting their opportunity to make a killing. They're trying to change the world in ways that protect just enough of it to keep them on top and keep the status quo that they benefit from. And so market world is individuals in the system. It's also institutions like the, you know, corporations that have CSR departments that try to help companies maintain a reputation that allows them to keep profiteering while gesturing just enough at change making. It's young people who go to Goldman Sachs and McKinsey with visions of changing the world, who are sold on the idea that it is only through learning how to do spreadsheets and PowerPoints at these firms that they can actually make change. And it is foundations that give away, in the name of social justice, the spoils of cruelly earned money. And it's social enterprises that seek to solve social problems while also profiting from the ongoing failure to solve them systemically for everybody. And it is therefore an ideology. Market world is driven by an ideology of kind of having your cake and eating it too, of being a social justice warrior and a profiteer. And in many ways, it is defined by the fundamental idea at the heart of so much of this, which is the idea that sounds great and is in fact quite sinister of the win-win.
Yeah, say more about that.
Well, the win-win is this idea that you can, you know, it's an idea borrowed from the world of market exchange. I mean, if you have money and I have ice cream and, you know, you want ice cream and I want money, well, we can make a trade and we're both better off, right? At least not counting the calorie effect, caloric effects. And so we can both feel good about that. That's a win-win. And win-win is a, you know, an established and perfectly fine concept within the world of trade and exchange and basic economics. What has happened in recent years is that the paradigm of the win-win has migrated from the world of trade and exchange to the world of social change. And it has come to be the highest praise you can give a kind of social change is that it's a win-win. You know, a consumer products company can help Africa. They're not actually sure where in Africa they're talking about, but Africa is a faraway place. You can help Africa while also the consumer product company profits by selling toothpaste in small packets to the poor. You know, so it's the win-win is visible when you have these impact investment funds that want to make a return for shareholders while also making a difference for the people in communities they help. You see it every time you go to the mall and someone's selling you a red iPhone case that's going to change the world, or some kind of tote bag that's going to change the world. We see these products all around us, socks that are going to change the world, even socks change the world now. And so this idea of the win-win is everywhere, and it seems wonderful, but it masks a very sinister thought, which is that the winners, or those kind of benefiting from the status quo, need to be in on the gains of social change. Well, this is like saying, you know, men need to benefit from the emancipation of women, and white people need to benefit from the emancipation of people of color, and rich people need to benefit from empowering the poor. Sometimes there are ways in which you can do that. There are ways in which you can empower those without power without hurting those on top. But really, when you're giving power to those who don't have it, you're often taking power away from those who have too much of it. And we've lost our comfort as a society with doing that in an age that has taken the market notion of the win-win and applied it to the pursuit of social change.
And you contrast win-win with win-lose, which is really another word for class struggle. You know, the idea that there are, in fact, competing interests, and that while there may be ways that competing interests can negotiate with each other, I think that's absolutely necessary, it's a whole different idea of the locus of power. So I wonder if you could talk more about that.
You know, the whole idea of politics, I studied political philosophy for many years, the whole fundamental idea of politics is the idea that there are distinct social classes with distinct interests that come together through representative organs of state and hash it out. The people who own land and the people who don't own land but need to make a living have different interests. there's never going to be a win-win between the people who own land and the people who don't. Landlords and tenants have different interests. People who own factories and people who work in factories have different interests. People who build disruptive technology in Silicon Valley and people who don't want their elections to be compromised by those platforms have different interests. And the whole idea is you come together in the political sphere and you have these organs of state that negotiate those tensions and represent those different groups and come to resolutions that make certain trade-offs, but balance the interests of people and figure out the common good. And that idea has been under assault in recent years by the idea that we should change the world in a new way, which is not the powerful and the powerless coming to the kind of neutral territory of the public square and hashing it out. Of course, that public square being less and less neutral because the powerful have captured even that with their money. But the new way that they offer is that they should just take on changing the world directly. They should be our reformers. And I think that's just such a profoundly dangerous thought because it is, frankly, feudalism. It's feudalism with apps. It's a kinder, gentler, slickly rebranded feudalism, platform feudalism, where the winners of our age are trying to convince us that we should essentially let them run the world and throw scraps down to us, and that will be change, trickle-down change.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Anand Giridhar Das about his book, Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. Yes, you called it the Earl of Facebook and the Lord of Google. This is, you know, really a profoundly anti-democratic movement that seems to have taken over the power in this country. And what you spoke about was the mechanisms of how that happens. I wonder if you could talk about what some of that ideology is. You talk about the McKinsey method, for example, and how the McKinsey method has been used to solve social problems. And this is how people are now trained. Even people who go to college and want to do good are being trained to go and work for corporations like Goldman Sachs and McKinsey in the idea that these corporations have the vital skills they need to create social change.
Yeah, there's been this amazing, amazing ideology that has ascended in over the last generation, which basically holds that if you want to make a difference in the world today, you have to do so using the technologies and values and mentalities and tools of capitalism, and in particular, the methodologies of consulting, management consulting, and finance. And this idea has swept through our society such that in many foundations, in many organizations that, you know, work for social justice in various ways, there's this notion that if you don't have a couple years experience at McKinsey or Goldman Sachs or a place like it, you're not a qualified world changer anymore, which must come as quite a wake up a shock to people who actually made change in other ways in the past, using activism and movements and fighting using the power of the law and systems. But as part of the kind of grip of market thinking in our age, there's been this idea that you have to kind of learn how to do spreadsheets, and only spreadsheet warriors can change the world. And it's an ideology that's brilliant because, one, it diverts many of the best and brightest people of our time into money-making fields instead of public service. And number two, it actually then, when those people move on to work in the public sphere, it helps to ensure that the kinds of solutions they come up with are solutions that are unthreatening to their former colleagues, the kinds of solutions that don't mess with the market too much and don't hurt the winners of our time and are congenial to power.
One of the things you talk about is the role of technology. You know, we kind of were brought up on a diet of the idea that technology is empowering, but it's also disempowering. For example, Uber and Airbnb, you know, have morphed from companies that gave people who had been, you know, laid off by the financial crisis an ability to survive financially, with the idea that, you know, everyone now becomes an entrepreneur. But actually, that has led to much less power on the part of many of these folks. And I know this well because my son drives an Uber than they would have had if they had been actual employees. And in fact, this is being fought out in the legal sphere now. Are Uber drivers employees or not?
Yeah, I mean, I think what often has happened, particularly with the world of tech and places like Uber is that there's this way in which they have told a story that they are not the figures of the establishment that they in fact are. They're not the wealthy winners that they in fact are, but they are really rebels upending a corrupt and powerful establishment. And because they think of themselves that way, they don't feel any kind of obligation to people like your son who work for them, because they're not big, powerful employers. They're rebels. And so what they do is they have made up a bullshit story that people like your son are micro entrepreneurs. That's the word they use. You know, they're micro entrepreneurs. They run their own business. Well, I guess anybody who's ever worked for a living, in theory, runs their own business, because also corporations are now people, according to the Supreme Court. So people, I guess, must be corporations. But the reality is your son or any other employee of any company is not running their own business. They are workers in an economy that has become very tough for workers. And some of the richest, most powerful venture capital-backed companies of our age, like Uber, take every pain they can to deny your son the basic dignity of being called an employee. Because if anything happens to him, if he does something to anybody else does something to him, if there's an accident, there's a problem in any way, they want to pretend they never knew him, you know? And in theory, I guess every company would love to do that. I mean, I'm sure Walmart would love to say, you know, if an employee slips and falls on the floor at Walmart while working because there's some liquid on the ground, I'm sure Walmart would love to live in a world in which it could say, sorry, that employee is running their own business standing in aisle 6. But, you know, we don't let them do that because that's an employee. And all this new economy stuff, I think we've been fooled. And these companies have been too cute by half. And they've built these billion-dollar valuations without being willing to acknowledge that the people who work for them work for them. And it's not right. And frankly, we need our government to step up and regulate these companies properly. And these little boy billionaires in Silicon Valley need to grow up and understand that extracting value from workers in society and building these billion-dollar fortunes and flying around in jets and going to conferences is not changing the world. It's screwing the world.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Anand Giridharadas about his book, Winners Take All. Yeah, and actually, there is another way. I mean, one of the things you talk about in this book is the ability to set the terms of the debate, to limit the landscape, basically, that people even consider. And you point out that there is another way of doing things, that technology doesn't necessarily have to hand over power to the Lord of Google or the Earl of Facebook. There's something called platform cooperativism, and I found this a very interesting idea. Tell us about that.
You know, platform cooperativism is a movement that started with a simple question, which is, why is it, if it's so easy to build all these tech tools these days, if it's so easy to build your own app. I mean, it's, you know, like building a Walmart costs a lot of money. Building Instagram, which ended up being valued at a lot of money, does not cost a lot of money. You got to write some code. You got to build the app. I mean, there's this opportunity in our age to really build things on the cheap that can be worth a lot. So why is it that workers and users and just regular people have not been able to have cooperative ownership of many of these apps? I mean, in theory, the Uber app is much easier to build than like a national taxi service of the old kind, right? So why isn't it that, you know, why don't we have an employee-owned Uber? You know, if it's so easy to build something like Facebook, you know, which was built in a dorm room and then became this very big thing, but in its early form was fairly simple. Why is it that those things are always built by and owned by the few instead of the many? So this movement is trying to kind of raise that question, highlight organizations like Fairmondo and others that are trying to build a different kind of model. It's very difficult. But again, I'm trying to point people in this book to ways in which different worlds are possible. And I think one of the questions to start with is, there are tools in our time, particularly tech tools, that have a certain empowering potentiality. And many of those tools have been captured by the rich and powerful to become tools of concentration, of power concentration. And they don't have to be. So how can people like your son be part of building movements that actually build like workers' cooperative owned Uber? That would be very exciting. How could we build a Facebook where we owned our own data and got paid for the content we share? We live in a world in which we tend to assume that these barons they are the way they are, but they're not. You know, tech can be built in different ways. It can go different ways. This era can swerve, and it needs to.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, where I live in East Hampton, New York, local taxi drivers got together and they did build an app on a local basis to compete against Uber, which was had been really cutting into their business. So that is an important point to make there. There's also another form, corporate form, that you explore here. I found that discussion very interesting because it is an attempt to try to solve some of these contradictions between doing well and trying to do good, being able to do well and do good in a more authentic way. And that's the benefit corporation, the B Corporation. And you have a critique of it, so which I found very interesting. So first, tell us why benefit corporations came about, and then what are the problems with them?
So the benefit corporation is this really remarkable thing that arose because the way corporate law works in America, there's this general understanding that companies not only tend to just do whatever is good for shareholders, but are actually maybe required to, in the sense that if they were not to put shareholders first, if they were to, say, be very generous to employees and earn lower returns, that they might actually get into legal jeopardy and they might be in a place where shareholders could sue them for not putting shareholders first. And so the B Corporation movement decided to create a kind of voluntary pool for companies that wanted to behave in a different way, where they were good to employees and good to the environment and good to their communities and stakeholders. And so they, you know, have gone around and they've passed laws in various states that give companies this other way of being a company, and it kind of reduces their chance that they're going to be, or eliminates the chance that they're going to be sued because they're now under a different law that gives them that full protection to be conscious and not be social dumpers. The critique that I make of that in the book, I mean, and again, many of the things I write about in the book, and I kind of set myself this burden as a writer, I'm writing about things that are good. I'm writing about things that are marginally better than not doing them. But I'm also writing about good things that uphold a bad system and that good things that therefore abet a larger crime and good things that are accomplices to greater harm. And one of the problems that I have with the B Corp model matches the problem I have with many of these good things, which is that it makes it easier, creates a way for companies that are probably already inclined to do good to be good. And it creates a kind of pool where they can bask in their goodness and share with each other and be celebrated for that. And that's great. But I actually think what we need in America is structures and systems that make it harder for bad companies to be bad first, rather than making it easier for good companies to be good. In other words, I think we need to, you know, make it illegal to be like Exxon more than we need to push King Arthur Flour or Ben and Jerry's to be good or give them a way to be good. I think what they're doing is important. But I think it's also reflective of an approach that's taken hold in the age of markets, which is voluntary social change. And I believe that, you know, it's more important to solve a problem like that at the root, change the law for everybody. So why should any company have the right to dump problems on our society and have you and me pay to clean them up? I don't think that should be a voluntary thing. A corporate charter is something we give to people. We allow companies to form, and they have limited liability and other social privileges that we give them. In exchange for those things, we should demand that they're not dumping sludge into our rivers or compromising our elections. That seems like the minimum that we should be able to ask. Senator Elizabeth Warren has a proposal out right now that would seek to do just that. So that's kind of one way. But I also propose something a little less out there, which is, I think we should maybe have two different corporate tax rates. If you're a certified B Corp and you're not dumping social problems into the society, you're going to cost us a lot less. We should reward you with, you know, 10% less of a corporate tax bill. And if you want to keep dumping problems into society, you know, and if we don't want to follow what I think is probably the better idea of actually just not making that allowed, then fine, we should at least tax you more for costing us the bill of the cleanup and recovery of the social problems you are constantly dumping in our lap.
Of course, that does beg a lot of questions about how you evaluate the social cost, which is critically important. And there are...
Well, that's what B Corp's doing. They've gotten good at that. That's the innovation. They've figured out a way to certify that. They certify these companies, they check, they verify, and they've invented a certification model that is very widely respected and used.
So another whole issue is, where is the locus of power? And, you know, back in the first Gilded Age went down ultimately with the rise of unions. And we have seen a huge erosion of unions. So I wonder if you could talk about the role you see for organizations that are of the working class itself.
Yeah, I think one of the most crucial things that needs to happen, a lot of the forms of fake change that I write about, change things without changing the distribution of power in our society. And what I am trying to push for is the kind of change that changes who has power. And one of the most important forms of power that needs to be rebuilt is the power of workers. And we need to restore the power of collective bargaining. That's why the workday is 8 hours and not 18. That's why children don't sweep floors in the stores of this country. That's why when you get sick or hurt on the job because of your job, there's some protection. That's why people get paid overtime. None of those things were the result of Mother Nature. They were all fought for through workers amassing a certain amount of power and leverage and using it to extract concessions. The powerful don't tend to concede. They tend to respond to power. So the evisceration of unions by the political right, but also, frankly, the failure of unions to maybe bring themselves up to date in the modern age, you know, make themselves salient to a new generation of workers that is more diverse, that isn't just white guys in factories, that encompasses people like your son who work in the gig economy. Unions need to also do a better job of finding a new relevance in the new age. And I think of all the kinds of change that could make a difference in America, that is one of the most important.
You've brought these ideas that are now in this book. You've spoken of them in places where these folks get together in the centers of power. What has been the reaction to these ideas of yours?
Well, I have to say that I have been actually profoundly gratified by the response to Winners Take All. You know, I expected a world of pushback, but the reality is people have been so open to the idea that maybe something isn't right, that maybe they're complicit in something they didn't see. And I've been really heartened by all the people who have reached out to me, but also just online reaching out to each other, organizing various things that I just observe as an outsider. A lot of the winners of our age that I see have actually decided to kind of, for whatever reasons, use this book to say, okay, this is a moment of reckoning. This is a before and after. Let's look at ourselves more carefully and think about how we build a better society. And I'm incredibly heartened that that's the kind of response it's getting. I think defensiveness is such a common reflex when there's criticism. And I do think there's something about living in the Trump era where we all have to recognize that we all must have done something wrong to get this dumpster fire. So maybe there's more of an invitation to actually look within.
Well, Anant Giridharadas, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice about Winners Take All. It is an important book, and I urge my listeners to go out, get it, and read it. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Anant Giridharadas. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from his book, Winners Take All. Next up, from the new feudalism to the new cooperatism. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. As we heard in the first part of the show, a new feudalism is on the rise. While monopolistic corporations feed their spoils to the rich, more and more of us are expected to live gig to gig. But as Nathan Schneider shows in his book, Everything for Everyone, an alternative to the robber baron economy is hiding in plain sight. Cooperatives. They're jointly owned, democratically controlled enterprises that serve the economic and social needs of their members. And free of the tyranny of the investor class, they can put community and environmental needs first. They often emerge during moments of crisis, not unlike our own, putting people in charge of the workplaces, credit unions, grocery stores, healthcare, and utilities they depend on. Cooperatives already comprise 10% of the global economy. In his book, Everything for Everyone, Nathan Schneider chronicles this revolution that's spreading within the capitalist economy while creating a more democratic alternative to it. Nathan Schneider, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. I'm so glad to join you.
Everything for Everyone, your book, the subtitle is The Radical Tradition That's Shaping the Next Economy. So you have two ideas there, radical tradition, something that's old, shaping the next economy, something that's new. And you open the book with a rural electrification cooperative that brought electricity to your grandparents. So that would be kind of traditional. Talk about the tradition of cooperatives in America.
Well, you know, over the last few years, I've been working with a new generation of people in this cooperative movement who are, you know, building businesses that are owned and governed by the people that they serve. And a lot of what they're doing is challenging. It's taking on new models. It's experimenting, in some cases, really radically. And I found a lot of inspiration in the legacy and things that have come before. Sometimes I feel like when I'm working with folks in this new generation, I would be irresponsible in advising them to explore cooperative models, except that so much has been built before. And I've started to learn to look around me and see cooperatives in places that I never knew they were, places like rural electrification, the hardware store down the street, being able to exist because of its purchasing cooperative. My family, who, you know, in some cases still farm in northern Colorado, are members of multiple cooperatives that enable them to maintain family farms. These are things that are not often talked about, but are a kind of economic revolution in our midst that is only partially complete. And with this book, I hope to kind of reinvigorate that imagination of what people a century ago called the cooperative commonwealth.
And you began this book kind of in the aftermath of the Occupy movement. How did Occupy inspire you to start in this exploration of the cooperative commonwealth?
Yeah, the book came out around the same time of the 10-year anniversary of the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy. And so I've been thinking a lot about how I've been spending, you know, the last 10 years kind of living in the shadow of that. The first half of that decade, I spent focused on telling stories of resistance. I founded and edited a news website about resistance movements around the world and got kind of swept into the Occupy movement in New York City. And my last book, Thank You, Anarchy, was about that. But then out of that work, I started to see more and more people who were involved in resistance were also building alternatives. They were building economies that they needed to survive. You know, once the protests were over at Occupy Wall Street, people had to figure out how to have an income and how to pay rent and things like that. And I saw them turning to this cooperative model, a kind of living democracy, a democracy in everyday life and in the workplace. And the more I learned about that, the more I realized, on the one hand, how many social justice movements in our history have depended on cooperative economies, from civil rights to the populists of the late 19th century and early labor movement and more. But also I started to realize how much this was about a lot more than just these kind of radical activists, often on the left, coming together and trying to enact some sort of utopia. That in fact, this is a movement and a legacy that cuts across our political divides in this country, and that this cooperative enterprise is something that we share, even among people who seem to agree about little else.
Could you give some examples of that?
Yeah, you know, it's amazing. Just a few weeks ago now in Washington, some historic legislation was slipped into the defense appropriation, as needs to be done these days. It's called the Main Street Employee Ownership Act. And it was kind of spearheaded by the office of Kirsten Gillibrand, a Democratic senator, but it was supported by Republicans and Democrats in equal number, just about as far as the sponsorship goes. It's a bill that enables more businesses to have access to financing and support for conversion to employee ownership. And this is something that shouldn't be so surprising. I mean, employee ownership is something that people like Bernie Sanders and at the same time Paul Ryan have supported for years and years. Both the Democratic and Republican Party platforms in 2016 talked about the need for advancing employee ownership for maybe different reasons, but with the same objective. And we saw similar things with a credit union bill that passed earlier in the summer, where both parties united around supporting small banks and credit unions. So this is actually something in a moment of intense polarization that people seem to agree on, that there should be more democracy in the economy, that it should be easier for small businesses to achieve economies of scale, that more people should be able to benefit from the profits that their labor is generating, that we should have a financial system that's more accountable to local communities. You know, all of these are kind of, in a sense, obvious, but the idea that there could be a movement that connects them and that there's a model and a history that connects all these ideas through cooperative enterprise is something that hasn't quite yet reached its kind of political critical mass, even though, especially since the recession, there's been a growing movement of people turning to this kind of model.
And Kirsten Gillibrand is my senator, so that's nice to know. So tell us, what is the reach of the cooperative movement in the global economy now? You say it's growing, but it hasn't been exactly tiny in the past. I just think, you know, as you point out in your book, a lot of us don't know that, you know, we're customers or even part owners of cooperatives.
Yeah, it's quite considerable, and it takes different forms in different countries. For instance, one of the countries with the highest density of cooperatives is New Zealand, largely because of dairy cooperatives. In Kenya, half the GDP comes through cooperatives because that's how much of the agricultural sector is structured for some interesting historical reasons. Here in the United States, a third of the population are members of credit unions. So different countries have their different stories and their different emphases. You know, here in the United States, grocery store cooperatives tend to be small and kind of marginal, though they have their significance. They've tended to be pioneers, but they tend to remain small. In Italy, the largest two grocery chains are cooperatives. One is owned by its consumers, and the second is owned by local retailers. So it takes different forms. You know, some estimate that cooperatives account for about 10% of employment globally. It's really hard to measure. Only now are we getting a U.S. census question on the economic census related to cooperative businesses. But as it is right now, we actually don't know how many there are. They're incorporated state by state. They're not always incorporated using cooperative statutes. So it can be a complicated question, but some really powerful minds are at work on trying to address some of these challenges. Suffice it to say, though, that this is a model that is everywhere. You know, this is the model that made Visa credit cards possible. You know, it was a spinoff from Bank of America in the early 70s that turned into a cooperative owned by regional banks that enabled the credit union business to really get going. The credit card business to really get going. So many stories like this, brands like Land O'Lakes Butter and Ocean Spray and Sunkist and Organic Valley, these are all outgrowths of generations of farmer cooperative organizing. There's so much of this legacy that we don't even notice. And you know, I think it's important that we begin to.
If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Nathan Schneider about his book, Everything for Everyone, The Radical Tradition That's Shaping the Next Economy. It's about the cooperative movement worldwide. Yeah, as you point out, I mean, for example, Cabot Creamery is a cooperative, but also REI. I've been a member of REI, I think, since the early 1990s. And it's a different kind of cooperative. It's a consumer cooperative, whereas Cabot Creamery is very much a producer cooperative. There's a vast difference in participation and control, two of the, you know, most fundamental, I think, values or factors that you talk about in terms of the cooperative movement, a vast difference in participation and control between the two. I mean, you know, basically I get my REI dividend check every year, depending on how much I've bought, but I don't really have any other input or control into that. Whereas the producers of at Cabot, you know, make major decisions together about how they're going to farm, how they're going to do dairying.
Yeah, you know, and in some respects, that's appropriate. You know, your knowledge of the business of REI, if you're a shopper there, is quite limited, you know, and you're pretty much there to, you know, get what you want and get out. And so it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for the business to pass a lot of control over to people who are just having that kind of relationship. But it does mean that both legally and culturally, the people who are in charge of the company running it day to day can think of themselves as trustees on behalf of their customers rather than trustees on working on behalf of outside shareholders who are simply seeking short-term profits. And that's a big difference, you know. And with something like Cabot Creamery, that's a business where how it functions affects, you know, the day-to-day life of the farmers who are members. And they have the incentive and the obligation to educate themselves about the functioning of that business. And so it makes sense that they should be involved. One of the things that has been really exciting to me to see in the last few years is an incredible explosion of development in new governance strategies. So new platforms deployed on the internet in particular that allow people to participate in governance more flexibly, recognizing that people may not have infinite time to participate in their cooperative, yet they can participate online in some finite and specific ways. And, you know, that creates some real opportunities for cooperatives, even like REI, that are relatively low touch with their members to at least get some meaningful input as they go. You know, I, for one, am grateful, for instance, that, you know, like REI isn't calling me every time they have a purchasing decision to make, you know, especially if we were to live in a world with many kind of overlapping cooperative experiences and relationships, you know, we'd want to make sure to find a balance between participation and free time. And so it's, you know, that kind of variety and flexibility is precisely what makes the model powerful and scalable.
One of the things I really love about this book, Everything for Everyone, Nathan Schneider, is that you don't shrink from talking about, you know, some of the challenges. I mean, the fact that, you know, cooperatives haven't always been true to their values or true to the ethics that animated the cooperative movement from the beginning. So tell us, what are some of the core values or principles of the cooperative movement?
There's actually a collection of seven cooperative principles and some accompanying values that have been agreed upon by the international cooperative movement spanning the world. And a few of those include, for instance, open and voluntary membership. Nobody should be forced to be a member. That members should have economic participation. So they should be both investors in the business as well as the beneficiaries of any surplus that comes through the business, that they should have democratic control. Then also that they should be involved in mutual education, that they should be able to learn about how the business functions and be informed participants in it. Also, there's the sense that cooperatives should be concerned about their community, that they should be engaged with the outside community, and that they should cooperate with each other, and that they should connect and find the overlapping opportunities that they have to work together and advance the broader movement. And that's something we see in particular in how cooperatives tend to form larger federations that enable them to support one another, create economies of scale, while also retaining local ownership.
Yeah, and they're all important. I like them all. But number seven, I thought, was so summed up something that is really critical here. The seventh principle is that the community is served as well, that the community is not an externality, you write. It's part of the business. And, you know, we're in a world in which corporate capitalism has gone amok and is threatening the very foundations of our existence, you know, with climate change and pollution and wars and nuclear development. I mean, the arms race seems to be more important than the survival of the human race. And that, to me, is, you know, if we are to survive, it seems that the idea of that the community is part of the business is so key. So I wonder if you could talk more about that and how you saw that, examples of that in the cooperative movement.
It's a funny backstory. You know, I mean, in Britain, for instance, the cooperative statutes, the laws that enabled the formation of early cooperatives, actually preceded the laws that are used for the kind of modern investor-owned corporation. These models were developing concurrently. And this idea that cooperatives should be concerned for community was actually, in the early history of corporations, you know, kind of presumed that corporations were being chartered by the state for some kind of social purpose. And that's something that we've forgotten. And increasingly, the investor-owned corporation, particularly, you know, publicly owned corporations, are structured in such a way so that their only purpose is to provide profits for shareholders. And even if a shareholder of such a company dislikes what they're doing for community-based reasons, like, for instance, shareholders of ExxonMobil who dislike the fact that ExxonMobil has been actively obstructing efforts to make progress on climate change, they can't actually oppose the company on those grounds. So when these shareholders in a company like ExxonMobil sue the company for damages, they have to frame it as if they're only concerned with their financial returns, which is crazy. And a cooperative is, you know, the cooperative model has been structured from the beginning with the sense that we're whole people going into this business. We're complex people with complex interests. And that in this business, as in any kind of democracy, we're going to reconcile those different interests, those diverse interests. Yes, we're concerned about economic return, but we're also concerned about environmental protection. And in a business like this, at the core of it, at the legal core, at the boardroom, it's a lot more possible to come in as a whole person and build a business in that context. And we see that in some contexts, for instance, with those electric cooperatives, when people have been able to organize and demand more community-facing structures. And then in worker-owned cooperatives, too, we see these businesses making decisions like, you know, our highest paid person is only going to be paid no more than 6 times the lowest paid person, or even less. Sometimes they just decide we're all going to be paid the same. They make decisions that may not be in the most obvious short-term financial best interest, but they're able to have a free hand to choose their values on the belief that often that doing so will be better in the long run. You know, it's why REI, for instance, is able to close the stores on Black Friday, you know, the day when everybody else is having their biggest sales day of the year. REIs are closed and they say, go out and enjoy nature. You know, that's what we're here for to begin with.
One of the great aspects of your book, Nathan Schneider, of Everything for Everyone, are all the examples that you have of the different kinds of cooperatives, not just the ones that we've, the traditional dairy co-op or electrical power co-op, but also things like the Sailor Sea Cooperative Finance Co-op that really embodies this idea of a community coming together to address a problem with those who have a little bit more, helping those who have a little bit less, but everybody getting a benefit.
That was a model where you had people who were more affluent in a community investing in refinancing the student loans of young people in the community and also advising them, becoming kind of full participants in their journey to become free of these loans and building real, genuine relationships as well as changing the financial dynamics. And that kind of mix, I think, is what really makes cooperatives powerful. A lot of the businesses in the world around us are designed to make more and more of our lives transactional. So, okay, I don't have to find a friend in a city I'm going to go visit, or find a friend of a friend and stay with them. I can just go get an Airbnb and, you know, pay whatever the going rate is. And there's a competitive market, so the rate will be relatively low. These businesses, and especially these online platforms, really seek to bring more and more transactions into our lives. And part of the promise of cooperative business is it really incentivizes people to build greater trust into their interactions, to you know, want to build relationships more, and to use transactions as a gateway into relationship and into community, rather than using transactions as an exit from relationships and community. And for instance, people experimenting with cryptocurrencies and, you know, and blockchain, like the technology behind Bitcoin, the people who are developing cooperatives with this technology are also trying to prevent what they see as a kind of growing trend toward financializing everything. They want to use this technology in a kind of radically different way than it's generally been used. And we just see this over and over again, this turn from alienation to at least the possibility of becoming closer together, of building stronger communities.
Nathan Schneider, one of the things you talk about in the book, Everything for Everyone, is platform cooperativism. Is this part of the so-called sharing economy? How does it differ?
Well, this language of the sharing economy emerged in the years after the financial crisis as this kind of new promise with companies like Airbnb and Uber, and this idea that we would share our things, our houses, our cars, and we would all need less and everything would be great. But the trouble is that language of sharing, I think, kind of turned on these companies. People realized very quickly that, you know, the core of these businesses was not about sharing. It was about a kind of extraction on behalf of their investor owners, taking locally owned taxi companies, for instance, and replacing them with a global semi-monopoly. Of course, it introduced some really powerful convenience and opportunity, but it's a shame that these had to be or were powered by a model of corporate structure and investment that encourages this kind of endless monopolistic takeover of the planet. These kinds of accessible, flexible platform-based businesses could also be developed on a more cooperative basis, where people are able to access each other, to connect with each other through technology, but be in charge of every aspect of the process and be able to keep the value in their communities. For instance, a few years ago, the Austin, Texas City Council drove out Uber and Lyft by actually just requiring them to follow the same safety standards as taxis. And during that time, before the state government overruled it, a local nonprofit ride-sharing company called Ride Austin, a new taxi cooperative, was developed. And, you know, Ride Austin works just as well as an Uber or Lyft. It charges the drivers a much lower premium, and it contributes back to the to local community organizations. So it really reflects a lot of these values that I think people would expect from something called the sharing economy, but it's built on a different basis. And this idea I've been involved in helping to grow, known as platform cooperativism, is an attempt to do that, to build really, in a sense, a real sharing economy in our online economy, and enable people to take advantage of these new technologies in a way that doesn't feel like they're and isn't just contributing to a monopolization of everything, but actually contributes to an ecosystem that is diverse and complicated and serves communities before it serves those who are simply seeking profit.
And finally, you talk in the book about one of the great advantages of the cooperative movement is its ability to create a new world within the confines of the old. It can coexist with corporate capitalism, but it can also create a different business model that can show the way for the future. So What's the potential for this new cooperative movement to create a different kind of global economy?
Well, it's a great question, and it's something that I've struggled with throughout writing this. To me, it's partly a storytelling challenge. You know, how do you depict this thing that is on the one hand so antithetical to the logic of the kind of dominant economy, yet is able to exist within it? That is something that reflects people's ideals and their highest ambitions, yet is also something that is flexible and is tolerant to compromise in a way that allows people to operate in it day to day. You know, when you look around at the cooperatives in your midst, in my town, there's a credit union across the street from a Wells Fargo. You know, on a day-to-day basis, most of the time, those businesses are operating, you know, virtually identically, probably. Yet there are critical moments where when hard decisions have to be made, they actually behave quite differently. And it leaves us with a series of questions. One is, you know, can this kind of model really scale to the point where more of much, much more of our economy could be organized in this kind of democratic fashion? You know, could we get better at democracy, good enough at democracy, that it could fill more and more of our lives? And, you know, I think that remains to be seen. We're in a moment where democracy is, you know, getting low ratings, so to speak. You know, the polling data seems to suggest people are losing faith in democracy. Certainly the political discourse suggests that. And I don't think that the solution to that is just to react and try to protect what's left of institutions that weren't working to begin with. I think what we always have to do with democracy is keep advancing it into new parts of our lives. And this cooperative movement is an example of precisely that. It's a flexible, creative space where we can develop the practice, the habits, and the ideas of democratic life every day, rather than waiting for the next election, rather than obsessing over what the president did or didn't say on Twitter today. And that, to me, is a tremendously kind of liberating opportunity. It says we don't have to let our democracy be limited and determined by one particular set of structures and whoever happens to be inhabiting them. But in fact, that democracy is something that we can be building in a variety of forms everywhere we go.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.